Makeshift Stories is now a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB.
Is there a place in time where logic breaks down and wonderment begins? Could that be somewhere or sometime along an indefinable line between the reasonable and the highly unlikely? Makeshift Stories presents a monthly journey into the improbable.
The tendency to assign meaning to perceived patterns in seemingly random or unrelated things is called apophenia. If you search the web for aliens on Mars or the Moon, you'll find thousands of articles claiming that evidence for this can be found in the photos taken of both celestial bodies. Experts dismiss such claims as apophenia in action, but could some be real? Would the only way to prove that be to return to those remote locations for a closer look? In this month's story, Choi Min-soo, a successful billionaire obsessed with what he thinks he sees in a 1972 photo taken on the last NASA moon mission, creates his own space program to prove his theory. He manages to confirm what he sees in the old photo, but finds much more than just dead ancient artifacts. We invite you now to sit back and relax as you listen to Makeshift Stories, episode 132, Return to Shorty Crater. Somewhere in some time, there may be more to discover than just a pattern.
Choi Min-soo brushed a gloved finger across the cracked, brittle photo. It was the first print pulled from negative shorty AS-17-137-20994. Over the years, he had memorized every rock, shadow, and detail down to the level of the tiny grains of silver salts which made up the image. He had paid a small fortune to have both the original NASA negative and the first print stolen from a public archive and replaced with forgeries. Such had been his obsession. As a teen, he had discovered the image on an obscure conspiracy blog, which claimed that Shorty Crater was in fact an ancient alien crash site, and the photo contained the evidence in plain sight. Like an earworm, finding out if that was true had become the background beat of his thoughts ever since. The image had a strange, almost mystical pull on his psyche. Like gravity, it just wouldn't let him go, and like that natural force, he never questioned its hold over him. Its mysterious attraction had grounded Min-soo and focused his drive. People around him, and any who ever met him, came away knowing that anything he applied his laser focus to would become successful. Even after his discovery of the water filtration technique, hailed as a world-changing breakthrough, there was only one ultimate outcome. So, when he began to divert the profits from Tefnut Water, the world's richest corporation, to start Horus Space Industries, the latter's success was all but a foregone conclusion. Min-soo carefully tucked the brittle photo back into its protective pouch and Velcroed it to the cabin wall beside his seat so it wouldn't float away.
"I'm ready," he said, trying to hide his nervousness.
Arjun Batra, the lander's pilot, nodded. Min-soo had lured the top Vyomanaut away from the ISRO, the Indian Space Agency, with a promise to get him to the moon years before his colleagues. A promise he was about to deliver on.
"Starting descent sequence now, Mr. Choi."
Min-soo felt himself being pushed back into his acceleration couch as the retro rockets fired, starting the deorbit, then cut out, letting the fragile craft fall toward the moon. He watched the bleak, gray, cratered surface grow closer through the portal. He could hear the occasional attitude jet correcting the trajectory. Other than that, the small cabin was filled with the beeping of equipment, humming of fans, and growing tension. Arjun, breathing much slower and steadier than Min-soo, reached out and touched a control on the main navigation screen, and with another burst from the attitude jets, Nana 1, named after the Sumerian god of the moon, began to rotate, the growing lunar surface smoothly slipping away through the portal as a dark starfield slid in to replace it. Then more beep and fan punctuated silence until,
"Final descent," Arjun announced in his pilot voice. "Main engine firing in 3, 2, 1, Ignition confirmed.
Nana One seemed to lurch. A loud growl replaced the equipment noise, and the entire cabin began to vibrate. Min-Su instinctively dug his hands into the armrests of his acceleration couch.
All systems nominal, trajectory normal, fuel 90%,
Arjun continued calmly. Min-Su forced himself to relax. He knew every word the pilot would say. He and Arjun had spent hundreds of hours in a simulator going through the sequence over and over. Despite his nervousness, reality was turning out to be disappointingly just like another simulation. But then that is what his board of directors had insisted on. There had been immense pressure for him not to go. However, going had been the point of Min-Su's entire adult life. He had done everything to lead up to this moment. No one understood that, of course, and the people around him were surprised when he accepted the demands for him to step away from the leadership of both corporations and appoint management teams that could run the companies if the worst-case scenario played out. But that wasn't going to happen. Nan Wan represented the best the world could currently create.
Down 100, 5 forward.
Arjun, arguably the best pilot in any space program at any time in history, called out.
Fuel 20%. 15 seconds. Down 10, 2 forward. Down 2. Kicking up dust now? Fuel down to 10%. 5 meters. 4. 3. 2.
There was a slight jar as the craft touched down, which made Min-Su's heart jump.
We are down,
Arjun announced, emotion creeping into his voice for the first time. Min-Su checked the chronometer on the flat screen displaying the mission schedule. 1954-53 GMT flashed in the corner. It was better than he had hoped, only 4 seconds off from the original time Apollo 17 had landed at Taurus Littrow exactly 100 years before. However, this time they had hit NASA's intended landing point spot on. Min-Su, the perfectionist, made a note to discuss the 4 seconds with the mission planners when he got back. They weren't running this mission with an onboard computer that had the processing equivalents of a contemporary toaster, like the Apollo program had. They should have been more accurate.
Thank you, everyone,
he said into his suit mic.
Near perfect, but let's nail it next time.
Then he muted the comms and took his helmet off. Outside, he could see the icy gray slopes of the South Massive rising above the valley floor. Min-Su was struck by how colorless the scene was. He had always imagined that the NASA photos had been bleached out with age.
Out my side, sir,
Arjun motioned, excited.
You can see Challenger's descent stage about 200 meters away, and to the left about 50, the LR. All just where they were supposed to be. All pristine. They look like someone just left them out there a day ago.
Min-Su craned his neck to look out the other portal. In the distance, he could see the sun glinting off the gold foil that covered the ancient descent stage's body. It looked like it had just been unwrapped, not 100 years old. Let's shut down the flight systems and get ready, he suggested, not looking forward to the struggle to get into the awkward Chinese EVA suits stored behind both seats, but he was anxious to get going. They had only a limited amount of time on the surface. An hour later, Arjun had decompressed the cabin and opened the hatch. Min-Su was the first to squeeze through the tiny opening and descend to the surface. It was late afternoon, the 20th day of the current lunar cycle. The sun, undistorted by a messy atmosphere, cut long, ink-black, hard-edged shadows into the regolith. Min-Su thought it looked as if the hand of God had painted them onto the lunar landscape. He panned the all-too-close horizon, then located Shorty Crater about 800 meters away. Faint orange streaks marked the spot. Unlike the Apollo mission, Min-Su did not have a rover. Even his wealth had limits, so it had been scrubbed from the plan to cover unforeseen costs. They would be on foot.
Found it,
Min-Su radioed Arjun, who had joined him on the surface. With the clock ticking, the two set off. 15 minutes later, Min-Su stood on the lip of the crater, comparing his view to the NASA photo he had called up in a corner of his suit's heads-up display. He was more or less in the same location. Off to the left, he could clearly make out the 100-year-old tire tracks of the lunar rover, leading back to the descent stage of the LEM. Behind, a trail of crisp footprints in the gray regolith connected him to Nana 1. Below him lay the floor of the crater, and in its center the debris field. It was shockingly obvious to him that it wasn't natural.
I don't know how they could have overlooked this,
Minsu radioed to Arjun.
Remember how long you have spent studying the photo, Mr. Choi. If no human eye had seen this before, I can understand how your brain wouldn't connect the pieces. It's the way the shadows break up the masses. Maybe so. We're now 20 minutes in on our EVA. Only 40 minutes left. I'm going in, Arjun.
Minsu started to walk down the shallow crater's wall.
It's getting more obvious the closer you get.
His voice barely controlled with excitement, he radioed back.
Everything is covered by a fine dust. No doubt the ejecta that settled back to the ground after the impact makes everything the same gray color, so from a distance it just looks like, well, rocks. But up close you can tell it's really dust-covered metal. Approaching the main debris field now, heading for the first body.
Minsu could feel his heart rising into his mouth as he apprehensively approached. He stopped near the center of the crater, where most of the debris lay, within what appeared to be a faint rectangle. Minsu knelt beside a desiccated dust-covered body, hesitated, then reached out experimentally, touched it, then froze.
Mr. Choi, are you okay?
Concerned, Arjun radioed. He waited for a response, and when none came, hurried down into the crater. Theon plastered his face to the portal, so he could look down and see the pillar of smoke pushing their small craft into the heavens. It grew wider as it fell away, dissipating, then, blown by the afternoon winds over the Emerald Sea, began to snake and twist. The other end of the ephemeral column appeared to grow out of the center of a shrinking oasis of green dots. The archipelago where he and everyone he had known lived. Theon would never see it again. He turned around to examine the hastily built cell that had been installed at the back of the tiny cabin. His temporary prison until they landed again on the moon. Out of instinct more than anything, he tentatively tried rattling the thick wire mesh, which formed his physical, and they hoped, mental cage. But ultimately, they feared him and what they thought he had released.
Settle down, Theon, and enjoy the view. It's your last chance to see the place that spurns you. And besides, even if you could rip it open, what good would that do? You don't know how to pilot this ship, and I won't help you.
Sira, the pilot-turned-prison guard, kept her eyes on the control as she spat out her words with venom.
Once we're around the horizon, you could always set me down on the other side of the world. How would they know?
Theon tried to argue.
I would know, and that's enough. I'm not a supporter, never have been. I volunteered for this.
Although he could not see her face, he knew she would have a gloating smile pasted to it.
Then you are a fool.
He stopped rattling the cage. She was right. He didn't know anything about piloting. He wasn't technically inclined. He had never needed that skill.
Do you think they're going to let you come back?
He prodded, hoping to appeal to the tiny bit of uncertainty he could sense in her.
They'll say you were infected by me on the way up, poisoned by my ideas. They're afraid, you know, frightened by me, by my ideas, afraid to see them spread. No, they'll claim I had 4 days to corrupt you. You'll be exiled just like me. It's not too late.
Theon turned back to the portal. The sky outside was getting dark now. The constellations and their familiar patterns beginning to make their presence known. He could see the curvature of Gaia through the haze of the thinning atmosphere. The great ice sheets looked like thick cream crawling down from the poles, the world he had known a valley of green and blue that separated the two.
We are already beyond the horizon. Lemuria cannot see us. If you cut the burn now, we will simply fall back to the surface somewhere beyond their reach.
Sira laughed.
Not likely, Theon. I'm immune to you. I've had the treatment. You can't get to me. And besides, you are behind that screen which is designed to block your influence.
She boasted. It was mostly true. The royal houses had commissioned their scientists to find a way to block the type of influence he could exert, but not entirely. She may not know that, but he did. Syria would not be going home. He just needed to convince her to face facts. So Theon tried again.
We're going to be together for a couple days, so why don't you tell me what your family name is?
Gerardimas.
She hesitated, then added,
But I'm captain to you. Now be quiet. I am preparing for orbital injection.
Syra, I know you don't believe me.
I told you to be quiet.
Theon reached out with his mind. He could sense the blocks the doctors had put into the captain's head. But they could not shut down her doubt, and that was his way in. He had 4 days to work on her.
You are the only thing I have to concentrate on. They know that, and they know the treatment is not perfect. Don't believe what you've been told about it. That was just propaganda to get volunteers.
There are those of us whose hate for you runs so strong that even if there were gaps in the treatment, we would still risk volunteering to pilot this craft. My family lived at the estates on Ikaria. I was away training.
Oh.
Theon flinched at the name. The Ikaria incident had become the rallying point for the royals and the rest of the ruling class. They used it to support their contention that Theon's ideas were too dangerous to be allowed to spread, were too dangerous to even exist.
I had nothing to do with that. It's been manipulated,
Theon defended.
I have never met any of the rioters. They were starving. They had no choice. They would have all died if they had not taken action. It was desperation. Have you ever been hungry, Syra? Have you ever had to watch your family and friends wither away? Yes, I empathize with them and abhor the situation that led them to become desperate. I've never condoned what they did, nor have I ever supported the system that drove them to such despicable acts. But the royal houses are blind to the effects of their actions. They stopped listening to me when they realized what it would cost them. No, Ikaria cannot be blamed on me. Besides, I was already in a metal cage at the time. How could my thoughts have reached them? It was an idea, their only solution. Ideas cannot be stopped. They cannot be wiped out like a virus. But the environment they spring from can be changed, if we are willing.
The engine suddenly shut off. Anything that hadn't been strapped down began to float. Syra checked the readings on her screens, then flicked on the radio.
Trajectory nominal, lunar insertion on next orbit as scheduled,
she said into a microphone on a long, spindly arm attached to the control panel. There was a beep acknowledging receipt of the message, then the transmission cut off, leaving only the ancient static of the universe to fill the vacant airwaves. Syra turned the radio off, brushed the mic aside, unbuckled, then launched herself at the cage. She reached in and pulled Theon against the steel mesh, so his face was pressed into the wire. She was so close Theon could smell her last meal on her breath.
Get this straight, devil. We don't want you. And, as we can't execute you, we're doing the next best thing. Taking you so far away that you can never interfere in our affairs again. You can't jump to me. You're trapped.
Captain, believe me, we are both going to share the same fate. This craft is on a one-way trip.
Theon replied calmly. His lack of emotion only irritated Syra more. She scowled, then ripped a needle from a pouch on the wall and angrily pushed it into Theon's body. He winced involuntarily.
Knocking me out won't change the facts,
he noted as the drugs took effect. He woke with a start. His dreams had been disturbing. He had found himself on Ikaria, trying to hold back the rioting crowds, urging them to put down their clubs and go home, to let him negotiate for them. He had tried to reach out with his mind and touch the thoughts of the agitated crowd to blunt their anger. But they were blinded by the violence of their thoughts. Suddenly, a hastily erected barrier collapsed as they surged mindlessly forward, pinning him underneath, forgotten, ignored, and ground into the soil. He shook the image from his mind. The royal families were fools thinking that he could control what their arrogance had started. They gave him far too much credit. He could not reach through hate. The events would cascade, and it would be the end of Lemuria. Removing him would not stop it. At least he wouldn't have to witness the violence. He had been their only chance, yet he, with all his influence, was not sure if he could alter what was to come.
"They told me to knock you out, so I wouldn't have to listen to your garbage and risk infection,"
Sira explained. Theon looked out the portal. The silver arch of Luna at half phase seemed so close that he could reach out through the thick glass and touch it.
"You've been misled, Sira," he finally said. "I cannot reach a person with my mind unless they welcome me in. Otherwise, do you think I would have let Ikaria happen? There is still time, Captain. We could simply loop around Luna and go home. However, I suspect they have made sure that won't happen. Why don't you check your autopilot?"
The low rumble of the main engine interrupted them. It vibrated the craft, making loose equipment rattle. Sira looked surprised.
"You did not expect that."
Sira's face had gone white. Her hands nervously flew across the control surfaces, pressing buttons, expanding windows, checking calculations.
"That should have been the turnaround to slow us for lunar orbital insertion,"
she gasped, her voice panicked for the first time.
"But the attitude jets didn't fire to spin us 180 degrees. So, the burn just added to our velocity? There must have been a fault. I'm checking."
"They have assumed you will be corrupted by me. They're not going to let you back. There is no shelter down there. Never has been. That was all just rhetoric to appease my supporters. But I can survive this, and so can you. If you let me."
"Shut up, or I'll put you under until we land. I need to concentrate,"
Sira yelled. Theon looked out the portal and waited. When he turned back a few minutes later, the young captain was sweating. She was desperately searching through manuals, resetting circuits, rerouting power.
"This is the Paralas? We have a problem. I need assistance,"
Sira began repeating into the transmitter, each time getting more desperate. But she was greeted with indifferent static.
"There is still time. Let me touch your mind."
"Never. I'll never submit to you or your kind."
Theon shrugged, then turned away from the frantic pilot to look out the portal again and prepare. The lunar surface seemed to zoom up toward them like the lens of a camera. It came faster and faster as gravity relentlessly pulled them down. Theon had accepted his fate, but in the back of his mind knew that it was not his end. There would be something after. All he had to do was move his mind away from the physical. He closed his eyes and concentrated, blocking the frantic sounds of Sira's desperate attempts to shut the autopilot off. She had gone from resetting breakers to tearing out circuit boards. He admired her dedication, but wished she'd give up the pointless fight and join him. She could share in whatever was going to come after. The impact was like a switch going off. Complaining equipment, screams, then nothing. Then Theon woke. In the distance, he could see two figures moving about. Completely covered in thick, white, puffy clothes, they loped through a brilliant gray landscape, set against a night sky darker than he had ever seen before. One approached the impact crater and began to set up a tripod. The figure fixed a box with a lens to the top. A camera, he realized. He reached out with his mind, trying to touch the figure, but could only make it to the chemically based photographic device. He lingered as long as he could, imprinting on the emulsion he found there, until, exhausted by the effort, went back to sleep.
When he woke again, the opportunity he had been waiting for was there, and he jumped. Min-Soo awoke confused. He was disoriented from the dream, or hallucination, or whatever it was that had flooded through his mind when he touched the desiccated body. That was the last thing he remembered. For a brief second, he thought he could hear Arjun call his name over the radio, asking him if he was okay. Was he okay, or was that a dream too? Was he even conscious? He wasn't sure, but tried to focus. He began to make out the wall of Shorty Crater and the colored streaks that the original NASA mission had come to examine. Then his vision became clear as a hand lifted away. Had he placed one gloved hand over part of his faceplate? He didn't remember doing that. Then, his entire environment suit came into view. It was like a weird out-of-body experience, except his point of view was as if he was lying on the regolith, but he couldn't feel anything. Min-Soo watched helplessly as his environment suit waved at Arjun, giving the concerned pilot a gloved okay signal. Then both turned and walked away, leaving him behind. He screamed, but no one heard him through the vacuum.
ATB has a cool program called ATB Junior, where Alberta elementary students run their own school bank. It's a learning opportunity, and often a chance for students and families to meet ATB's leaders. If you want to learn more about the great things ATB is doing, head over to atb.com. Have you ever wondered why some people seem to have their dream job? Then you should check out the Work Not Work Show at worknotwork.show. Makeshift Stories and Work Not Work are proud members of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. If you're looking for other interesting podcasts, please go over to albertapodcastnetwork.com and check out some of our other shows. We hope that you've enjoyed this month's story. As always, if you like what we are doing, please tell your friends about us, or write a review on Apple Podcasts, or Stitcher Radio, or join us on Facebook. We love hearing your comments, so send us an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com or visit our website at makeshiftstories.com. We release a new story every month between the 15th and the 20th. This month's episode was written by Ellen V. Hare and read by Mitchell Tu. The opening and closing themes were composed and recorded by David H. And don't forget to listen to Series, which is posted around the beginning of the month. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons, non-commercial, attribution, no derivative license. Which means you're free to share our stories, just remember to credit us, and don't alter anything.